Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data. With us today from Databix is Amit Pawa. Amit has a long career in data, particularly focused on the importance of naming things, which is today's topic. So metastores, how we name our data elements and our business activities across the enterprise. And as he said in our discussion and prep for this, life in data should not be this difficult. So he's dedicated a lot of his time and energy to making things easier for all of us. Amit, welcome.
Thank you.
And would you, for the listeners, give us a brief intro to yourself and your passion in data, and then we can get into today's topic.
Yeah, sure. So I've been working in data for a little over a decade now at various companies. I'm currently at Databricks working on the internal data platform team. And previously I was at Airbnb for around 6 years working on the internal data platform team there as well. Most of my time across both these companies has been working on metric stores and making it easier to produce and consume data in a consistent and accurate way, making sure that businesses could make good business decisions.
Yeah. And so one of the fun things about having you on today is you've got both been in data, but been in data from a different perspective than some of the rest of us have been. Right? Like you're the one making the tools that people use, right? Like both at Airbnb now. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of us who live in the data space who are the practitioners who will, you know, go to Home Depot, buy that really great hammer, buy that really great saw, get to work. But, you know, you have been in the position both internal to Airbnb and then now at Databricks where you are the enabler of many different things. And that's an interesting skill set because you both have to be good at the craft so you know what people need and want. And then also, you know, be able to see the pattern. So, you know, I guess before we talk about your passions around metric stores, why don't you define that a little bit for folks, just so we know, you know, where you're coming from and how you view the metric store and this importance of naming things.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, before I was even working on these internal tools, I actually went through an evolution. I started off actually as a BI consultant doing analytics and pipeline generation. I was a data engineer. And then while I was at Airbnb, I actually evolved more into a software engineer building out the data tooling. So it's been great working on both of those things. And I think it gives me that right level of elevation to make sure that we're building the tools properly and in a way that actually drives value. But yeah, getting back to the metric stores, simple one-liner for a metric store is it's generally just a single source of truth repository for business. Mm-hmm. That's really what it boils down to, but there's tons of different types of metric stores. And you'll see these kind of implemented in various ways and different tools. They can vary from as simple as a consolidated list of pre-aggregated tables, like some core tables central to the company, where users don't have to do joins and pre-aggregate or aggregate the data themselves. They can just query them simply within their BI tool, to KV stores. This is similar to, say, what Uber did with U-metrics, and all the way to more complex ETL layers like we did at Airbnb and what we're doing internally here at Databricks, where it handles a lot of the actual table manipulation, as well as then providing APIs for accessing metrics directly. The real difference between all of these comes down to how they differentiate themselves in how global and consistent you want the metrics to be. Mm-hmm. So is when you're creating the single source of truth, do you want it to be a single source of truth for the company, the organization, for the product domain? Are you just creating data marts, right? Mm-hmm. And then also, are dimensions part of the metric? So should the dimension semantics be consistent across metrics? And do you want to enforce this, or do you just want to trust your developers to do this themselves? I tend to lean more into the more complex one with the most level of consistency, but people have their different.
And I loved one of the ways you put this in our prep conversation when we were picking, like, hey, what might you talk about? And that was enforcing the dialogue and its ability to happen around these differences, that there should be tension. Because if people are passionate and care about getting the right information, you usually are going to disagree on the definitions. And that can provoke very insightful and important dialogues, right? Like, it is going to be hard to, particularly the larger the organization, it is hard to just name something one thing and, you know, have it, you know, have that mean the same thing in all contexts, right? Right. It's like the, when you look at, and if you're going to tie, like, so you said BI, you said an old, you know, a dated term there. Well, it's not dated, but it's still like, I'm not sure like everybody's learning BI these days. They're calling it something else. But in the early days of BI, when the Kimball and Inman wars were raging rampant and people talked about bus matrix, right? You know, you're sitting there talking about like the nouns across the enterprises, but not just the nouns, but like the metric, you know, those, that was always the key thing in dimensional modeling, was like, get your nouns, because that was the hardest thing. Get people to try to agree on the nouns across the enterprise. But usually the values, because those values were done in isolation in those individual transactional systems, but the nouns is what tied it all together. But so when for you, for a metric store, it's both the nouns and the values, right? And you're even talking about dimensionality to those, like this KPI or this value could mean something different, and maybe even have a different name if I apply different dimensionality to it.
Right.
How have you, you know, what are, so you did a lot, and I believe the program that you were, or tech stack that you were working on at Airbnb was Minerva. It's an open source. If you talk a little bit about why did Airbnb get to that? Because I think that gets to this other question we have, is what are common challenges in the org?
Sure. Yeah. So I think a common thing that most companies will see when they are missing a metric store is that there's, as you were saying, inconsistent metrics and terminology. My favorite story came from Airbnb around this, where Brian was in a board meeting and was asked, well, how many visitors come to the website? Right. He didn't have access to some central tool initially, like in that meeting, like offhand, where he could just go get that number. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, I'll come back to you, right? So then he goes, he queries his data leads, he emails them and says, hey, someone give me this number, right? Mm-hmm. Five different people, five different answers, right? And none of them were necessarily wrong. That's what's really great about, one, the story, and then also about like this problem area. You're not necessarily wrong, you just have different terminology that you're using. And that's also kind of where the complexities come in when you start to do LLMs around data. So like you need to have a common set of terminology across your company so that not only can people get you exactly what you're asking for and they understand what you're asking for, but then when you try and automate these things later on with LLMs, the LLM can then actually have a consistent set of terminology that it can then make its decisions off of. And so that's essentially what happened. Five different people, five different answers, and he couldn't give an answer to the board, right? So that is one of the things that spurred the creation of Minerva at Airbnb. Mm-hmm. The other thing was when I joined Airbnb, we actually had a bit of a metric store going already, specifically for experimentation. Airbnb is really, really big on experimentation. They run thousands of metrics in parallel at any point in time. Back when I joined, it was in the hundreds of experiments at the same time, and there was a huge emphasis on making sure that the user journeys for running experiments and measuring experiments was really solid. And so that user journey was largely focused on making it extremely easy to start up an experiment and then attach metrics to that experiment. So we had a central repository metrics where you could attach a metric to an experiment and you could then understand how your experiment was doing, and you could actually compare them across experiments, and you had a clear understanding of what was going on.
I think the other interesting thing about, like, when you mentioned the tension and that it should, like, the by having metric stores or however it's implemented, right? Even if it's just an idea, like a process, and you don't even have tools for it. But the point you're making earlier on even just having this concept and that you create the tension, it also poses this opportunity for discovery, right? If I end up back to not only just resolving differences, but those differences might, you know, underline somebody's new or, you know, important viewpoint into how the business works, right? Like early in my days, I came from a call center background and we always talked about average, you know, average handle time. Well, did that handle time include, you know, what we would used to call after call wait, right? When like somebody, usually the rep, the sales rep or the service rep, customer care rep was like sitting there logging notes. That's typically what they would do. So was that handle time include that? Did it include like some other buffer time that we could measure off the switches and everything? You know, what was included in that, right? And like, and different groups, as we were, you know, moving out of regions and looking at this globally, different groups did different, you know, different things, but everybody called it average handle time. So, but to your point, it's like we can have those conversations and decide like, how do we slice that, or how do we build either new meetings or new metrics that we know that.
So. Yeah, exactly. And so with that metric store that was there, we were seeing that. We saw different people coming in, and all of this was in GitHub. So we saw different people coming in and making PRs to say, okay, this is how I define this metric. Oh, this is actually a little bit wrong, what you've done. Let's tweak that a little bit. And they come to a consolidation or a consensus within the PR and then merge it in. But additionally, on top of that, because this was isolated to experimentation, we then also saw people coming in saying, hey, this doesn't align with the business metrics that I'm seeing in my team dashboards, right? Mm. Your experimentation metrics don't go into our team dashboards. We have our own logic in our BI tools, right? In Superset and Tableau, right? And so that is when we made that shift. That's when like Minerva really got started was, my manager and I came together and were like, I'm spending more than half my week helping people figure out why their metrics aren't the same. Right? Yeah. And that's just me. They are then going and they've spent a week debugging this before they even came to me, right? They got fed up and came to me. And so we're like, there's way too much friction and way too much thrash going on here. Too many hours are being wasted. There's got to be a better solution here. So we decided to create more of a global centralized repository. And that's where spawned Minerva.
I think that, there's a good question I just thought of, and it's maybe a rephrasing of a point I was trying to make earlier here. But if we, because I know there's going to be people listening who come from like the traditional data warehousing background that I was in, which is like, well, wait, you know, that should have been resolved if you did proper modeling, right? But I think, and from one standpoint, that can be a true statement. On the flip side, there's a couple of things that have happened now in data that don't make that statement either true or easy to get to. One, we hardly dimensionally model our data all the way out anyway, right? We might put some, you know, several different layers on to curate, but we certainly don't instantiate across the entirety of the enterprise, because you're talking about scales where, man, if Airbnb had spent time to try to resolve at a modeling layer all this dimensionality and these definitions, everybody would still be working on it, right? So what I think there's an important thing that you're talking about here is that it's an old problem, but there's new approaches that you have been looking at because of the scale and the size of the data states. And the fact that, like, you know, we used to have, when we talk about dimensional modeling, and you used to have just one team or two teams working on it at best. Now you're talking about an incredibly data forward organizations with many people access to a lot of data. There's no way you're going to model the entire universe, right? So you're talking about collaboration at scale in a way that I think that's an important context to, just so that there's other kind of folks like me who have come from that background of, you know, one team, working on dimensional modeling and building, you know, as we used to say, the right answer at the right time with the right information, was the old taglines. But you're looking at this now new paradigm, cloud scale analytics, hyperscale analytics with many teams and that and others. This is a very much a collaboration type approach.
Exactly. It's really focused on the whole democratization of data, right? Self-service data, where we've spent a decade figuring out how to get all of our data into a single blob storage data lake. Mm-hmm. It's no longer in across all these various data marts, right? So now how do we actually enable everyone to self-service on this and we democratize this data? The way to do that is to, or at least my opinion, you don't rely on a single centralized team to model everything. Mm-hmm. What you do is you set some standards for basic modeling that everyone can follow, some intuitive guidelines and some tooling that kind of leads them along their way. And that's part of what Minerva did. Minerva was largely built around a star schema approach with fact and dimension tables. We called them event sources and dimension tables or dimension sources. Mm-hmm. And it guided people through that approach of building out a star schema without having to have that centralized team enforcing that model. And it meant that you could move a lot faster. You could evolve almost at the same speed as product, ideally at the same speed as product or faster, right? And that's actually another issue that I ran into. So even before at Airbnb, I built a metric store of the like core data style of you have centralized tables that are all pre-aggregated metrics at various different granularities. And that is in its own way a metric store, right? But it's super easy because people don't have to denormalize tables themselves. They don't have to aggregate data themselves. It's all just there for them. But at the end of the day, you end up with some severe bottlenecks. You end up with a centralized team having to work to reconcile the difference of opinions of terminology across teams, across orgs, across the entire company. And that slows you down in you're not able to keep up with the rate of change of the product. And as soon as that happens, people start to DIY and you're no longer the source of truth, right? And everything falls apart.
It's you know, the quote we would put into presentations when we're talking to us, you know, the Jurassic Park, life finds a way, right? I have been in some of the most consulted inside some of the most locked down environments I've seen, you know, where it's like IT would get alerts if somebody plugged in an errant USB device into a computer, right? And yet, you know, the data warehouses that people would build on like machines that they coupled together at the end of the row or just, you know, spanning across a cut is, you know, before cloud or before that particular org use cloud. But people find a way, all right? And if you don't make it easy and you don't make, have you read Nir Eyal's book on Hooked?
No, I haven't.
It's a good one. I like it, but it's like, because I've kind of taken that the approach in the consulting space when we look at change and change adoption. You can build something great, but if you don't, so somebody will go through a lot of pain to use something if the utility is incredibly high. If the utility is lower, and utility is something very specific to that person, right? You could think somebody could get high utility out of a metric store, but if their goals in their department it's different and they're getting what they want, like the utility actually that may be high overall for the org, but low for them. So you have to make the friction has to be near, you know, zero or very low for them to go get in and use it. So loads of great things in that book, but that was just one of those things I took away from, you know, when we look at change and change adoption, how do we make the utility either super high for their context or if it's high for the org, but low for them, got to make the function, the ability to use it really low. So getting on the, one of the other questions I had for you then is like, when you look at how do we implement metric stores, both process and people and tool wise, you know, what is this, you know, what does that kind of mean putting aside? I mean, yes, you can talk about it in the context of Minerva, but also what does it generally look like? You know, just, Because yeah, I think absolutely. people are feeling the pain as you're talking about it. Everybody's like, oh gosh, yes, I've got that. Please preach on, Mr. Pava. But yes, how let's define it. What does it look like when these things are implemented?
Yeah, so I think what you just said, it really resonates a lot with metric stores because the utility and the friction evolve over time with mm-hmm. a metric store. There's a definite flywheel in play here where in the beginning, it is extremely high friction. You don't have anything in this metric store. So you're adding everything from the get-go. And most likely what you add is not going to last very long.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to quickly evolve, right? So my strategy there, my suggestion for anyone who wants to approach this is start from the top, start with leadership. Get them bought in, make sure that the company is bought into having a data-driven mindset. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is to have a dashboard that leadership looks at on a regular cadence that tracks all the company priorities, right? All the metrics that lead into the company priorities. From there, you now have a pretty solid list of metrics across the company at a top level, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the base level metrics across the entire company. You've got points of contact across all the organizations of the company. You're set up for success there. As a centralized team, you are onboarding these metrics. And so you're eating up most of that friction, most of that burden. And then as soon as you have that program running where they're checking that on a regular cadence, there's a natural incentive for all of the individual organizations to then want to onboard because they're going to want to know how they are contributing to those top line metrics. And they're going to want to make sure that whatever dashboard they're looking at, whatever they see differences in the metrics that they're looking at is exactly the same as what leadership is going to see, right? So if I'm moving my metric 5% and it is, and I want to see leadership see that same 5%. And the great thing about the metric store is that because you have those top line metrics in there, all these other organizations can just simply contribute dimension. Yeah. So they're contributing their dimensional slices. The metrics already exist. They're just adding a little bit more, right? And then everyone just keeps on adding a little bit more here and there, here and there, here and there. And eventually it becomes everyone's just leveraging each other's predefined definition. The only new stuff you need to add is when product evolves mm-hmm. and something new shows up, right? And it very quickly becomes this flywheel and you end up with, you can cover a lot of permutations very, very quickly. The Airbnb metric store, while we had too many top line metrics. There were a couple of thousand top line metrics. Ooh. But even that, we had thousands of dimensions. And those dimensions had hundreds, dozens of values. So you had millions of potential permutations of metrics that you could compute. We weren't computing all of them, obviously, but you could. And so the flexibility was there. And the key thing with this centralized tooling was we enforced naming. So one name, one meaning, one semantic, one definition. So all those conflicts that we talked about earlier were resolved as things were added. And if you didn't have everyone in the room initially, that's fine. It's there in the code. That is now the source of truth. And anyone who disagrees can come in and contribute and disagree, and you can evolve it over time. To me, this also then leads into another key thing. And the reason why I lean into the more complex ETL layer style metric store, in that you need this whole process in order to reduce friction. You need to handle a lot of the ETL for the users. You want to make it as simple as possible and as easy, as quick as possible to evolve the definition. Mm-hmm. If someone disagrees on a naming, you need to make it very, very easy for them to say, okay, I talked with this other team. We're going to switch to a different name. And everything else is going to update automatically. Tables are going to update. Views are going to update. Dashboards are going to update. The data in all the reports is going to update magically, right? And in order to do that, you need to take over a lot of the ETL and handle that centrally. You don't want all these individual handoffs between teams. And you especially don't want to have to deal with sending out PSAs to tell people, hey, this column's changed, go update your query, go backfill your tables, go update your dashboards, right?
Yep.
Go delete that report, that PDF you sent out to the, to the CEO, go send him a new PDF. You don't want to be in that state constantly.
I think there's let's hit on another tension point you just mentioned, because for our astute listeners out there, they will have noticed that, wait a minute, we started off talking about democratization, and now the last little bits have just sounded like, you know, the overreaching big brother, big sister, right? Like trying to control my life, because he just said centralization several times. So wait a minute, what model are we talking about here? Are we talking about centralized, decentralized, federated, you know, laissez-faire, right? But I think if anybody has read what might be today considered the penultimate vision in massive decentralization, the data mesh, right? Like even Degani, you know, says at the end of the book, right? Like there's at certain scales, like centralization of functions is important. And that's a little bit what you're getting at here. So just so we kind of both, you've stated that tension of everybody being allowed to innovate and do stuff with data, but then there's centralization. So there's both support and tension in doing that, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll have to forgive me, my understanding of the definitions of both these terms is potentially a little off, but the way that I view it is it's both a little bit data mesh and a little bit data fabric, where you have centralized platform, which standardizes your ETL process and your ops model, right? Your centralized team can handle the majority of the pain of managing and operating the tables. But the individual teams, the logic itself is federated. You want the people closest to the specific product area to be the ones that own the logic that describes that business area, right? With that model, you end up with somewhat of a data mesh where you have the federated ownership and people are contributing their own individual pieces of business logic. But then you have the data fabric in that as you combine those individual separated layers, it's all automated.
I wouldn't worry too much or fret about whether you have the right definition or not. I think we're all fighting to see who gets to define it.
As far as I could tell.
Yeah, it's almost like we could benefit from having a metric store for our industry, right? But you know, let's be real. It's like everybody. It benefits the grayness around this benefits a lot of people. You know, and the pessimist might say it benefits the vendors the most. I think probably maybe 10 years from now, we'll actually have more common definitions around this stuff. I don't know who's going to stand up and do it. You know, I think I don't know if we'll ever be the way like electrical engineers are, right? Like you really don't want people messing around what the definition of terminology in there. Otherwise, we all might get fried. So maybe we'll settle this out, but I think everybody's fighting for a better definition of those terms.
Yeah.
But
I'm glad I'm not alone in not being super clear.
You don't even have to go to a data conference and play the game of telephone. You just can go ask 10 different people and you'll get 10 different answers. This isn't even like just running around in the circle of the table, like whispering in each other's ear. Everybody's going to give you a different answer when pressed for details, right? And I've tried that. So I have definitely tried that and gotten different answers from people on their understanding of things. So that's why it's like, in one hand, like one of the places I worked before, our quality metric for looking at our consulting engagements was two questions, and that was it. Oh, balloons are popping up. So it's two questions, and the first question, and everybody on the team needed to give the same answer for this, and it was what is the outcome that we are delivering for the client with this project. Mm. So it doesn't matter if you were the data engineer or the business analyst or whatever, the outcome always stayed the same. Then the second question could vary. And the second question is like, and then how is your work contributing to that outcome? Like map your work to the outcome. But yeah, it's like, that sounds simple, but it's crazy the amount of gaps we found just by asking those two questions and nothing else. We didn't even bother too much with like, are you following the same ETL patterns? Are you doing like your, you know, we generally trusted people would read the patterns and follow things. But that understanding alone was key. And it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but it's still as hard to even get that measure of consistency.
Yeah. And it's very easy to overlook that as a company is growing, especially when you're at some of these companies like Databricks, for example, grew from 1,000 employees to 4,000 employees in 2 years.
Yeah.
Right. When you're bringing on that many people, it's hard to keep everyone aligned unless you have a very solid program and process around it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so admit my bias on this topic is it's very much a cultural process. I mean, you hit on there's very successful tech patterns. This is an age old problem, but yet like we still run into it, right? We still, you know, have this challenge and say, you know, your answer on how do we start to solve this, it leads with the buy-in tying to why this should be important to a company. And you can highlight that at the highest levels. It's like, how are, you know, you are not getting the information on either this financial dashboard or this, you know, the new territory growth, you know, initiative. Like you're not getting the data you expect. So this is why, right? Like this is how these things are happening. So outside of, you know, Minerva, what are the other things that you've focused on to help solve these problems, to basically fix people and fix orgs?
That's a difficult question. There's,
and you can protect the innocent if you want. You don't have to name all the names.
Well, yeah, I'm definitely not going to name any names. Yeah. So outside of the metric store, sorry, what was the question again?
You know, you've got the technology initiative that you've done over the years with the metric store, but you've also mentioned, you know, the cultural way you did it too. Right. And so you've talked about the process, but so what are other things that you've done outside of just the tech to solve this problem?
Yeah. So there's been one of the big things I'm actually working on right now is incentivizing good behavior for owning data. So the data platform, a good data stack will make it very easy for people to produce data, right? You want to reduce the friction and let people just get their work done. If they are trying to answer some questions, just like unblock them, right? But what you end up seeing is that people create tables all over the place. They have unknown quality, particularly they have unknown contract. And people will go and do a search and they will use whatever table they see, right? Like, even if it doesn't have a clear contract, they'll say, oh, this data looks about right. And they'll start using it. So something I'm working on right now is what we're calling a data integrity score. Mm-hmm. And so that is, well, one, how do we go about documenting things? What are our expectations? Somewhat of a service checklist for those software engineers in the crowd. A service checklist for tables. It's surprising to me when I talk to other people of how many times they'll say, yeah, most of the tables in our data lake don't have table comments. They don't have column comments, right? Those are foundational things. People who come from old school data warehousing would be terrified of like these sort of patterns, right?
Yeah.
Everything's supposed to be super well documented. Well, we need to kind of evolve back into that state. Right. So we're starting to set up a program.
They would be both appalled, but also they'd know that we were just as bad back then.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, believe me, if people were good at it, I wouldn't have had a job. Right.
So, yeah, that is true. That is true. Yeah. but So we're building out this centralized tooling to kind of measure all these things. So what are our standards for documenting tables? What are our standards for documenting columns? What documentation do we expect to exist? Essentially, what do we expect there to be in a data contract? And are all those things instrumented and cataloged, mm-hmm. documented, right? And then we do additional things. So like, what's the reliability? So we'll have a centralized SLA tool. We'll have centralized data quality check reporting for, so everyone can have their own data quality checks, but then we'll report the metadata to a central place that can be tracked centrally. How well trusted is this? You can use some heuristics for that. How many people are querying this, or how many dashboards are on this? And of those dashboards, at what level are they being viewed? Is this like an exec level dashboard or some mm-hmm. individual person dashboard, right? You can use a bunch of heuristics to do that as well. And then you generate a score. And so you plaster that score everywhere, right? It's on the tables. You sum it up and include it in dashboards. It should be everywhere. So as soon as, and then you train everyone in the company to actually look at it and respect it to some extent. If a leader is looking at a dashboard and they either don't see a score or they see a low score, they need to ask why, mm-hmm. right? I don't trust that dashboard. It is telling me not to trust it. So why should I trust it, right? So building out that sort of culture is something that I'm trying to work on right now.
Yeah.
And Airbnb actually put out a blog post recently. Mm. I will name somebody, Clark Wright, over at Airbnb. He's an old friend of mine. He worked on this at Airbnb. And so we had some conversations with him. He came and chatted with us about what they did as well. And I know there's a lot of other initiatives at other companies in the same sort of vein.
Yeah. Well, and I like the, you know, going to continue to applaud these efforts because it's, and now that we're talking even more, I think you're going to love Nir's book. I highly, highly recommend it because, you know, the challenges we're talking about are not new. And you know, maybe you're looking at rose-colored glasses, like I'm thinking that there were certainly plenty of good data warehouses and where comments were nice, lineage was tracked, lineage was kept, you know, how this data, where it came from. And then but at the same time, I mean, one of the things that we talked a lot about in my early days is in consulting was that, yes, we would build, you know, the data warehouse and the analytics store so that people could get the answers they needed to get the business, but also expect we're going to also log all the dirty laundry from around the enterprise and start dumping it in one rip. So you're going to realize how much this is stinking pretty quickly, right? And so be prepared to do some work. But then, you know, it's like, okay, well, why wouldn't people do the work to do that? Well, because unless it actually impacted what the business needed to do on a day-to-day basis, like they've all been operating fine, right? Like we kind of forget like how strong habit guides, you know, our actions. Like most people, not everybody, but most people don't have to look at their bank account day to day to know how much money they have to spend, you know, at every income level, right? Like you know roughly how much you make, you know what you're spending on things, and you can, without having to look at dashboards daily on your spend, you can know how, get it, you have a feel for how you stay in the budget. And that's like the way a lot of us approach business. We have been doing these things, we're patterned in practice. So we can take relatively few data inputs, you know, from, you know, the ops telemetry around us, like my sales, whatever, right? Like I can see this, feel it, and know roughly. But that's not an excuse for continuing to do what we're doing. It's just now we have to know the challenge we're fighting against, right? So now I'm trying to inform your model, right, on why certain things aren't working because you're just might be continuing to try the same sales tactic or the same customer service tactic or, you know, whatever it is. You're trying the same thing over and over. So how do I make this new, better, and different?
Yeah.
So I love the data integrity scoring. It was like the, I remember putting up a dashboard one time for like Dell when the call center is like, hey, look at this dashboard, but it's only got 65% of your data, by the way. because we operate 33 call centers around the globe, and this has, you know, I don't remember the number what that is, but it's got like 20 of them, and then the other, you know, out of the other three it has, it's got like, we're missing data.
Yeah.
Because we're paying for 500 reps and I got data on 400.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's a pretty large gap.
yes, it is. So that gap was big enough. People felt compelled to solve that problem. So mm-hmm. sometimes you can get people to solve, solve the thing. But
I think that, you know, that actually brings up a good point mm-hmm. of a lot of the times when it comes to data problems, mm-hmm. Things get solved in isolation or get viewed as too small to mm-hmm. solve because everyone's going about things in a different way.
Yeah.
If you have 200 engineers all building their own tables using their own separate tooling, and one of them says, oh, we had this incident, this would have solved it, let me go implement it in mine. Chances of you running a program to go get all the pipelines updated, pretty slim. You might even say, this isn't worth implementing because we're not going to be able to implement it everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? One of the other reasons why I really like this more ETL layer approach of the metric store is because of that centralized tooling, you can actually do some of these things which seem lower leverage, but are actually super high leverage because you can impact everything all at once.
Mm, yeah.
So for example, forecasting, targeting, anomaly detection, those are explainability for metric changes. And then these are all things which if you have a centralized tool like at the metric store where either it's doing the ETL or it gives you this API to be able to access all the metrics all at once, building any one of those tools, which might take months, might take a couple quarters, as soon as it is built, you can apply it to all of your metrics. Right. So, we've submitted a paper talking about forecasting and anomaly detection. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's approved yet. But one of the things that did was because it leverages the metric store as the backend, mm-hmm. they didn't have to spend all the time saying, okay, what type of metrics do we need to support?
Yeah.
How do we go get the metrics defined? We don't have to run a program to go get all these people to contribute the metrics and instrument it. It's just as soon as they build it, as they're building it, they have a repository of metrics that they can test things on,
yeah.
they can play around with. And then as soon as it's launched, it's available to everyone with just a couple lines of configuration. Right.
Which segues into another interesting thing we're talking about. So Databricks had big announcement. So I think we'll probably only publish this episode a week after this was really big hit in the news. But Gen AI, LLMs, and then all the other pursuits around some of these, you know, mega models. I don't know if that's really a term, but I hang around my kids too much, so I will say things the way they say it sometimes. So all these mega models to rule the world and make our lives better. But surprise, surprise, it only works well if you have good data. So what's the impact you're seeing on things like, DBRX and others where, you know, these metric stores and these ideas to properly and commonly name things, you know, are driving, you know, our potential here.
Yeah. So, and I'm not speaking as a representative of the Databricks. Yeah. I'm just speaking as a person in the data community, but, I see a lot of value here as well. I'm obviously a little biased here, but I view one of the biggest issues with LLM specifically for data, and there's been a lot of companies trying to tackle this problem over the years. Mm-hmm. A huge problem with this is not having a nice, clean catalog of terminology, right? You don't have the definitions of this is what this term means here. This is what visitor means in our company. This is what product means, or if like serverless, if I'm borrowing from Databricks terminology, mm-hmm. or Airbnb, like guest or host or something like that, mm-hmm. right? All those terms mean different things in different organizations, and you need to have that glossary. The metric store can serve as that glossary because it you have all the metrics defined there. You have all the dimensions defined there. And you should ideally also, that tooling should also include things like the owner and a nice freeform text description, things like that. You can then also collect all these sorts of heuristics of how often it's used, what reports it's used in, all that to kind of guide the LLM down the correct path. Mm-hmm. So that if you ask it, hey, how many visitors did I get in the past month? It'll give you that right answer, because there's not five different data marts or five different people with different definitions. It's just one person, right? It's one LLM looking at one set of nice, clean, golden table that is enforced to be consistent in naming and semantics.
Yeah, it's. I think it's easy to forget that we are, you know, the eyes, the ears, you know, all the senses for, you know, the LLM or for these things. Like they don't observe. We do. We feed the observations. We feed that information, and so they're only going to understand it as much as we essentially allow them to, and we can allow them to understand it better if things are named well.
Yeah. I think what you often also see is, because of these restrictions, LLMs will often be like, the user journey will be focused around, hey, select one or a handful of tables, or maybe one schema, or if you want a database, whatever term you use. Again, we need a better glossary for this. I'll do LLM on top of that, right? Yeah. You can ask me questions about this narrow set of tables, right? And so that leads to, again, kind of narrow, very specific answers, but might not align with what other people see and get answered using their tables. And you'll also see companies building these tools. So when I think of metric stores, I actually also view Tableau as somewhat of a metric store, right? Every single Tableau notebook, or I forgot what they call it, but each one of those has its own metrics defined in it, right? There's a little mini metric store in each one of those.
Yeah.
But it's not consistent.
No.
Every single one is going to be slightly different. And then it's all locked in there. There's no REST API for you to get that metric out of there and push it into a forecasting model or a explainability model or something like that, right? Yep. It's all locked and gated. You need these central, shareable tools where you can unlock that leverage, your data leverage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's funny that you mentioned Tableau, because it's having been a lot, done loads upon loads of Microsoft work in my career. I was one of the things that we ran into this problem enough, just like you mentioned, loads upon loads of, you know, very data eager people doing very amazing things. Power BI is what we ran into the most. And so one of the guys on the team just script the ability to go discover all the Power BI that were published out there and rip through it to get all the metrics, like what was inside it, not the data itself, but it would rip through the metadata to say what tables, what definitions, what calcs were built. And then we kind of pulled all that to, cause there was one financial services org we came into where there were 1700 Power BI notebooks published across the enterprise.
That is 17, too many.
17, yes, too many. 17, and this is like they were essentially all their own mini data. So it's like 1,700 mini data warehouses is what there were. So it was headed run rampant. And so as we told their clients, like, you have an incredibly eager data org. So all we need to do is figure out how to point folks in the right direction, and you are going to do amazing things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, so many people, so many different functions now know SQL. It's almost expected for almost all functions to be able to write a SQL query and be able to use data to help inform how you go about your day. So there needs to be better governance. Needs to be better controls. And it's not reasonable to expect everyone to learn how to be a data engineer. Right. You just have to make it easy and intuitive.
Yes, exactly. That's a whole separate conversation. Could be a fun one, but that's a whole separate conversation.
Absolutely.
Well, awesome. So If you don't mind, give folks a preview on your next rounds of research topics before we wrap up.
Oh.
And you know what? And you can answer this question both on work or anything that kind of is fun and exciting outside of work too. So you choose. It is your destiny here.
I mean, I will vote for non-work. I am really trying to make a good baguette.
Ooh, all right.
I did a trip to France a few years back, and I just, every couple months, I'll think back of driving through the mountains. We'd stop off and get a baguette every few hours.
Yeah.
Butter, cheese. Jeez. And we were just snack. It was just, nothing beats that.
No.
Oh, and yeah, I tried making it 2 weeks ago, and there was just complete lack of flavor. The texture was perfect, but there was no flavor. So I'm going to keep hacking away at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know what? I would, there are some places you can order. There is, you know, one of the things just in making, like getting good at, you know, making biscuits, like there's a big difference in like getting soft winter wheat for making your biscuits and your bread versus like some of the other harsher wheats. But there is also big difference in like some of the wheats that you can import from France or from others, and like even like the, you know, organic grains that we can get here. But no, the bread journey, I love that journey. Like my kids would be very happy to see if you can make a great baguette, because they all love carbs.
Well, I'll let you know if I figure it out.
All right, awesome. Well, Dan, thanks for making the time today, and look forward to all the awesome things that y'all are doing over there at Databricks. And, you know, again, love this topic because, man, gaining common understanding across, you know, all of our different groups inside an organization is a key thing. And it's the more informed we can have conversations, I think the better we all can, you know, work together.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening and being an advocate of the data culture community. Curiosity intersected with data can inform and inspire change for the betterment of all. Let's build cultures to make this happen. If you have a topic, want to be a guest or chat, reach out to me, Sid Atkinson, or my co-host Lee Harper on LinkedIn via DM or via the Data Culture Podcast LinkedIn group. If you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, please do so anywhere you get podcasts. Be sure to join our LinkedIn group to engage with your fellow data culture changemakers and visionaries. Thanks again for listening.